You ready for me?
I'm ready for you, sir.
All right. Good afternoon. We're going to open up the very short timed Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is February 15th, 2017. Colleagues, today and for the public out there, we're going to continue our public hearing on House Bill 5002, Department of Administrative Services. Director, we're going to ask you to come on up. And Paul, why don't you kick us off with any thoughts we need to think about?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I believe there should be some responses, if not right now, from questions yesterday up on OLS. They'll be up there shortly. We just got those posted, get those a little while ago from the department. So they'll be there for you to review. And then today, I believe the department is going to move on to the service side of the agency.
Perfect. All right. Madam Director, the floor is all yours.
Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chair and members. Katie Koba, State COO and DAS Director. Look, I two acronyms right off, but you know what those mean now, right?
We're getting better. Yeah.
And I can guarantee you we can get through our presentation in no time at all. It's how many questions.
We're the holdup, huh?
That's exactly right. So I'm going to have Madeline Zeit come up, again, the Chief Human Resources Officer. We have a few additional slides to finish on the Human Resource Office. We had a good discussion yesterday and really appreciate your thoughtful questions in some of the challenges that we're facing. And so Madeline's going to finish it up, and then we are going to move over to the service side of the agency.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Smith and Manning, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Madeline Zeich. I'm the state's Chief Human Resources Officer. There was a question from day one that I wanted to make sure that I talked to you about. And you had asked about the one-time costs of the HRIS system, the Human Resources Information System, versus the ongoing costs. So we don't have a slide that reflects that, but I wanted to make sure and give you that information, at least verbally, so you had it. So as with most systems, the vast majority of the costs of the $18.5 million that we have in the policy option package is a one-time request. So that's a one-time request of $12.1 million of the $18.5 million for an implementation vendor, initial project staff, and we talked yesterday about an independent quality assurance vendor. So 12.1 of the 18.5 is for initial implementation costs. Also, since we're starting the project and we'll need to purchase a subscription, there's another $6.4 million for this biennium for the software subscription or software license, whichever the term is that you like to use. And then that $6.4 million carries on after the implementation period of about 18 months.
So I have to share with you really quick, and I don't mean to interrupt, but it was really it really helped me when all of a sudden I understood it was a license rather than a system we were building. And so if I had 2 cents of counsel, it'd be let's talk in those terms. I think a lot of legislators feel much more comfortable once they understand that.
Okay.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith. Yeah. So, and then there was also a question about the funding and the statewide assessment for the 17-19 biennium and beyond. It will be the cost for this will be recovered through a statewide assessment to all agencies, and that's been something that we've been talking to ELT about and small agencies. So I believe they're well aware that that assessment will be happening. So that was pretty much it on that update, unless you have any other questions. And I had just a couple of slides left. This, of course, is our last slide on the Human Resources Information System.
Yep, we do have a question here really quick. Representative?
Thanks, Director Zeich. Since you're doing a subscription-based thing or a cloud-based kind of thing like that, does that mean that we can't use any of the Oracle resources that we got out of the settlement there, or is that a possibility or not?
Co-Chair Smith and Representative Nierman, that we actually are doing an Oracle assessment side by side. We're in the gap analysis with the system that we've chosen up to this point, and we also required by the OSCIO to do an Oracle assessment. And so we've contracted with a vendor to update our business case to do that. And so those results will be available just about the same time we're done with the fit gap on the subscription vendor. And so that'll be the middle of March. So the answer to your question is no. We can still use those if there's a decision made that that's what we choose to do.
Good. And can I follow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nierman, I might want to add, I'm learning about IT and obviously this system. The difference between the vendor that Atrus has its eye on, which is the license, and us not building a system versus the Oracle product that would be available. The Oracle product would require in-house IT staff that we currently don't have. So that is a there's a different approach if we went with the Oracle route that we've got to build into this fit gap analysis. Ultimately, where we end up, we're not sure yet.
But you haven't,
but
you haven't made a decision yet that would exclude that or would make that have to happen then.
No.
Good. Can I follow with one more? Sorry, actually, not. This isn't a follow. This is a different line of questioning. So I understand that you're about 3 months behind the date on your intent to award. Ordinarily, you award the contract 3 months after the intent to award. I understand you're about 90 days behind on that. Is there anything that I could read into that? First of all, is that true? And is there anything I can read into that? Or is there trouble? Or is it a bump in the road? Or
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Nierman, it really was about timing, timing for the funding request, when we could make the funding request. The RFP took quite a bit of time because we're trying to use best practice and include a little bit more information. We talked yesterday about wanting to get more employee engagement and the workforce more engaged. But the primary reason, I don't think there's anything for you to be concerned about or read into it, other than we have timing, you know, for requesting funding in the budget, timing for these meetings, so there's really there aren't any unanticipated changes to the schedule.
Can I just follow real
of course.
Quick? I'm ruining your timeline, I know, and I'm going to make you look bad. So, but when you did the intent to award, then that shouldn't have anything to do with these hearings or anything like that. That should be your procurement process operates kind of, I want to say, independently of the legislature, but at least not on the timeline of the legislature, right? Mm-hmm. So we're not slowing you down. What is slowing that down is it can't be that, right? I mean,
well, Co-Chair Smith, Representative Nierman, I think, as I mentioned just a minute ago, we do have the Oracle assessment that was new for us, and so we want to make sure that we do that right. We have a Stage Gate 3 requirement to have that done before we can continue with the contract award, as well as a requirement, of course, we're not going to award a contract until funding is approved through this body.
Mm-hmm.
But the Oracle assessment came, the requirement for that and that settlement came pretty late in our project, as you heard. You know, we were about 3-some-odd years into it, and I think there was then some determination about what's the process look like for an assessment, what kinds of information will we need, what will that scope look like, and we were working with the OSCIO and waiting to hear from about some of that. So I think that was one of the reasons that, you know, this was a little bit later while we were trying to kind of sort out what the implications and opportunities were for that.
Good. Thank you. I'm still getting my brain around the whole process and procurement and stage gate and how all those fit together. So some of this is just me learning, and so thank you. Thank you for that.
Any other questions from the committee?
All righty.
Okay. I will continue with just the couple that I have left. So this slide is one of those, I think, that we talked earlier in the presentation that appears a little confusing. So I'm just going to give you a little bit more information about this. One of the things that was the case in DAS is that there was this group called the EHRS, Enterprise Human Resources Services, and the Chief Human Resources Office. And so there was a decision made that those two units would be best served, and we'd reduce duplication of effort if we move those two units. So you'll see when you look at the CHRO budget, for example, the first bar chart there, you'll see that we've increased on this chart for 2015 to 2017 from $11 million to $33 million. A big chunk of that is because of the human resources information system. But there were also positions, but not all of them, that were moved from enterprise human resources systems into our Chief Human Resources Office budget. So I just wanted to point that out to you, that the difference and the reason that you're probably looking at this, or you could be looking at this and saying, you know, that looks really unusual, that's why. We're working with LFO staff, and we'll continue to do so to make sure that everything is in the appropriate areas, but this was also kind of a late move in the budget cycle.
And Mr. Co-Chair, I just wanted to also let the committee know. I think Representative Fahey asked the question yesterday. We've got a lot of shifts, and so we're trying to figure out a way to demonstrate to you in a simple fashion how that works. So our staff is still working on that piece. We haven't lost it, but in a way that makes sense.
Stacked bar charts.
That's, I'm thinking multiple ones on a page so you can see what increased and decreased, but it's complicated.
Mr. Chairman.
Of course.
I mean, the basic idea is we want to understand for the $33 million, how much of that $33 million is due to shifting employees versus not. So stacked bar chart, whatever. I'm a data person, so.
We'll work on it. Thank you.
And then last but not least, for me, we have some reductions in both the Chief Human Resources Office and the Enterprise Human Resources Office budget. And the first one is to eliminate our executive recruiter. The second is to eliminate administrative support training, training and development specialist, and to reduce our Department of Justice fees. And the third is to eliminate a safety specialist within the Department of Administrative Services. With that, unless there are any other questions.
Yep, Representative.
Are those positions that are currently full?
I'm thinking about just today. Co-Chair Smith, Representative Marsh, there are two positions that are occupied right now.
And follow-up? Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Do you have a plan for those individuals or those layoffs or those shifts?
Co-Chair Smith, Representative March, we are working on a plan. We have a plan for at least one of those employees, and we're working on a plan for the other employees. One of the things that I do is I like to, even though it's difficult to share this kind of information, I've shared the information pretty early with employees so that we can help them start to marshal their resources to find opportunities for them. So we've found one for one person, and we'll keep working on the other.
Thank you.
Let me ask one last question before you scoot. As I look back on the current human resource system, page 34, with the new software that's going to be acquired, should the big dogs approve of it, does our current computers, will they handle that new software?
Co-Chair Smith, that's one of the pieces of analysis that we're doing as part of the project is to make sure that our environment is suitable for this type of system. One of the nice things is that these types of systems are made for mobile technology. They're a little bit more flexible without purchasing
that's
hardware.
My concern. Are our computers, are they up to date to handle that software?
Mr. Co-Chair, we have those big square boxes, do you think?
Right, I know. Well, that's what I visualize when you see that.
I know.
You know, the big monitor that's this deep.
Co-Chair Smith, I think we are pretty fortunate. In most of our agencies, they have some modern technology. This particular system, actually, you know, you can see it on a PC screen like we have. But most agencies, and I would say almost all agencies, I'm assuming, have PCs that, you know, that people have available. They're not still working, thank goodness, because every time I pull up the screen, I just, you know, I have the same reaction as Senator Manning every time I see it. But I think that we probably have the infrastructure in place without significant purchases, but we are doing an inventory and making sure, dependent on the system that's selected, that we're ready.
Okay, well, I didn't mean to micromanage on that, but all of a sudden it just clicked with me. What if that software isn't compatible with our computer?
I just asked one of my staff there the other night, how are we doing on that?
Okay. Representative.
Quick question. So I think the question that Rep. Marsh asked about which of those positions are vacant was a very good one. And I would suggest that, you know, any of these budget presentations going forward, when we have proposals about reductions, that you, when there are positions being eliminated, that we talk about whether those are vacant positions or not and whether they're long-term vacancies or not. I know in the appendix document there is a list and some details about the long-term vacancies, but it's kind of hard to match that up with the proposed reductions. So.
Okay.
Any questions
we're done
for
with
me?
The
Mr. Co-Chair, are we good?
Yeah, we're good. I, my position on this is that I think that it'd be very difficult for hackers to get into this system because the technology is so primitive. You know, they're so advanced.
Right. They wouldn't even be able to understand what they were seeing if they did get in.
Perhaps we should keep it.
So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We are ready to move on to the kind of final area of the department, and this is indeed the service side. So I'm asking Brett West to come up, who is DAS's new chief administrative officer. So now you truly do have the blind leading the blind sitting at this table with you. But between the two of us, I think we'll get through this information. And so I am going to have Brett introduce himself and start talking to you about the chief administrative office side of the agency.
Thank you. Chair Smith, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brett West. I am the Chief Administrative Officer at DAS.
Brett Smith?
No, you didn't.
Okay.
You said Brett West. Thank you very much. It's better than what my mom used to call me. Yeah. So that's, on the slide that you see here are the programs underneath the Chief Administrative Office umbrella. And to give you a little bit of a context, Enterprise Goods and Services has 240 FTE, and the budget is $195.5 million. Enterprise Asset Management has 196.5 FTE and $93.8 million, and DAS IT has 39 FTE and $13.1 million. I'll get into the details about what each of those teams do, but wanted to give you an idea about context here. There's been a lot of discussion over the last 2 days about voice of the customer, and so I also wanted to tell you about the fact that Enterprise Goods and Services and Enterprise Asset Management have customer utility boards that help guide the work that we do. They help us set rates, they help us set performance metrics, service level agreements, and those types of things, and they've been a really great experience for us and for the CUB members. On the Enterprise Goods and Services CUB, we have the Department of Corrections, Judicial Department, the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, the Military Department, the Board of Accountancy, the Department of Revenue, Department of State Lands, Oregon Department of Transportation, and the Department of Housing and Community Services. We've tried to balance large, small, and medium-sized agencies and add some of those that actually use our services on a client agency basis, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. For Enterprise Asset Management, the CUB is made up of Department of Justice, Agriculture Department, the Real Estate Department, the Marine Board, Land Conservation and Development, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Judicial Department. So there's varying, I guess, expertise that we have on each of these CUBs. Some of them own buildings and assets, and we wanted to make sure that we also had, again, in the case of Enterprise Asset Management, clients of our real estate team. That's the piece I was most worried about.
Got it.
So DAS IT, DAS Information Technology, there was some discussion over the last 2 days about the Office of the State Chief Information Officer and the internal DAS IT shop. So we have a much smaller shop. We have 16 FTE that are on the Technology Support Center side of the agency. They are field techs and provide infrastructure support and man the help desk. So they're the kind of this kind of staff that would come around when you're having a problem with your computer to help you make sure that it's working correctly. Mm-hmm. On the application service delivery side, we have 21 FTE, and those are the aging COBOL programmers we've been talking about over the last couple of days. Mm-hmm. They provide support to several of the statewide systems that I'll talk about in a moment. The Technology Support Center has about a dozen, 13 I think it is, client agencies that they provide support to in addition to DAS. So the Governor's Office, the Board of Accountancy, Appraisers Certification and Licensing Board, and several others, primarily small boards that don't have the resources that to do the work themselves.
So Chair, this would be an example of kind of that shared services mm-hmm. model where those smaller agencies buy their IT help from us and don't have their own IT set staff.
So let me ask a quick question on that. So is each one of those agencies charged the same rate?
Co-Chair Smith, yes, okay. They are for client agencies.
Is that? Let me just ask this question. Is it in general one rate is set, or are there different rate schedules based upon budget sizes?
Co-Chair Smith, what our Cubs have really worked hard to do is make sure that there are no subsidies across the services that we provide. We used to have pretty heavy subsidies in the past for these services. We've gotten almost entirely away from that.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay.
I would mention that while Enterprise Goods and Services and Enterprise Asset Management have customer utility boards, there is not one currently for the internal DAS information technology team. We do have an IT advisory committee made up of DAS staff that's been established, and they are kind of the governing board for DAS IT. But we are in the process of going around, because this is a fairly new program, we want to make sure our internal CIO, Chief Information Officer, meets with all of these agencies. And we expect that by the spring we'll have another body set up, not a customer utility board, but probably regular meetings of all of our client agencies. This is just a little bit more language around DAS IT. I think I described most of what's on the screen here. There is one thing I would like to point out. I'm going to have to pull out my phone here. The green screen that you saw when Madeline Zeik was up here and showing the HR system, our payroll system is essentially the same thing. It's a green screen. It's a very old system, 30 years old. But we have spent some time with the applications development team putting together a user interface so that employees don't have to go mess with the green screen. The portal is mobile, and it can be done on a desktop. I can log in right here and enter my own time. You probably don't want to watch me do that, but it's much easier than it used to be. Way more efficient in having our managers lock time, which is what they do when they approve time. And we've had this adopted by about nearly half of all employees across the state. Agencies make decisions agency by agency. They're not mandated to use this. We did develop as part of our overall payroll assessment, and it's been quite a big hit. And I think one of the most popular things we've done. Our team also provides the IT support for the statewide accounting system. We have the programmers for the current HRIS, our PPDB system that Madeline talked about yesterday. We provide support to the statewide data mart. That's the application where you can go out and see all transactions that have happened through the accounting system, through the payroll system. It was really stood up to provide more transparency for state government.
And, Mr. Kocher, I can tell you, when I was still at the Department of Agriculture, we did adopt the new e-payroll system, and our staff are delighted with it.
Excellent. Excellent.
This slide has a missing bar because DAS IT is newly brought back to the Department of Administrative Services from Enterprise Technology Services. So we didn't tease out that budget from 2013-15, but you can see from this biennium to next, now, there is a bit of growth in that budget, and I'll talk about that a little bit later in the presentation when we talk about budget packages. And by the way we have this set up, we have an overview for each of the three divisions, and then towards the end, we go in the same direction that you've seen before, talking about the budget drivers, the reduction options, and the policy option packages. So Enterprise Goods and Services has five big programs beneath it. One is statewide procurement services. The state's chief procurement officer lives in that bucket. There are 59 FTE there and $15.8 million for their budget. Risk management has 23 FTE, $128.2 million, and most of that money is in the risk fund. Shared Financial Services is the team that provides accounting services to DAS and to nearly two dozen client agencies. I'll talk about that a bit more in a minute. 31 FTE, $7 million. Financial Business Systems has 36 FTE, $11.8 million budget. They are the business side of the, they're the business owners, I should say, of the payroll system, the statewide accounting system, the data mart. and maintain those systems. They work closely with the IT side of the house to make sure that we're keeping those systems up to date. I would mention at this point that the payroll system is quite manual. We're hoping that the HRIS project that you're considering will go through, and we hope that the payroll system will be the next in that wave. We have to do manual updates every time there's a change in PEB benefits, public employee benefit board benefit packages, or when union contracts go through, we go in and do all of those things manually in there and have to do them in a pretty small window at the end of the year. The last team we have on the list here is publishing and distribution. They do nearly all of the state's printing and mailing, and they have 86 FTE and a budget of $30.8 million.
Can we go back really quick?
Sure.
Well, you're about to talk about procurement services.
Yes.
The question I have is there like a big giant Sears catalog where agencies can go in there and look for stuff? How does that work?
Pardon me.
During your presentation, if you could just take a moment to talk about that.
Mr. Chair, there is one really more in the works, I would say. We don't have an easy-to-use place where you can go shop for anything you want. But within the ORPIN system, we do have yes, thank you. Thank you. That is the Oregon Procurement Information Network, I believe the N stands for.
Right.
And that's where we post all solicitations. So our requests for proposals that go out, we post all contracts in there. And that's really the place where people can go to see what we have. We hope at some point in the future to have something more like the Sears catalog, but we don't have it now.
Got it.
In that... May I say ORPIN?
Yeah,
so
of course.
Thank you. In that
so
ORPIN system.
Really quick, just, we do a 101 and just talk just briefly about ORPIN at a very high level so everyone knows what that is.
Yeah, at a very high level, it's the system of record for all procurements in Oregon. And in that, as I said, we post all of our statewide price agreements. It's a system that vendors can go into and see what opportunities are available to them. They can respond to those opportunities, and then we post all of the information there so that you can see contracts that have been put in place. I was going to talk a little bit about...
Really quick before we move on, colleagues, I would share with you, if you haven't had a chance to go into the ORPIN system, go take a look at it. It's pretty fascinating. Plus, it's a great way for each of you to share with your constituents about opportunities that might be available to them in your district. Anyway, I didn't want to interrupt you.
Mr. Chair, that's great. In fact, before I talk a little bit more about what's in ORPIN, I'll talk about statewide price agreements because your comment about making sure that all of your constituents know what's available to you, we have two people on the procurement team who actually go out and talk to local governments so that they know what's available to them. Representative Smith, you're familiar with Kelly Stevens-Malnar.
She's one of my favorite people.
I know
she's
she
awesome.
Is. I'm always happy to bring up her name. But what she and her team do is make sure that all those local governments across the state know what's available to them through statewide price agreements. Since we're talking about statewide price agreements, I want you to know that there are over 340 statewide price agreements in ORPIN right now. Those are available to state and local governments and special districts. Over half of the spend, 57% of the spend, is through the local governments and special districts. And I think, to me, that's a really important number because while state agencies are mandated to use statewide price agreements, local governments are not mandated to use them. We believe that we're giving them a really good price, and it also prevents them from having to go through the process of doing one-off procurements themselves. Many of them don't have the staff to do that, and even if they do have the staff to do that, they can free up staff's time to do other things. For fiscal year 16, we had $469 million spent on those statewide price agreements. 105 state agencies used those, and there are 710 ORCAP members. ORCAP is the Oregon, I had to write this one down, the Oregon Cooperative Procurement Program. This is available to cities, counties, special districts, school districts, community colleges, universities. They have access to those. We do charge a fee on the front end for them to be ORCAP members. But for a small agency that has a budget under $3 million, that fee is $200 annually. It does go up to $5,000 for organizations that have budgets of over $150 million annually. Also, as part of those statewide price agreements, one of the major funding streams for procurement is generated through those statewide price agreements. The idea behind the vendor-collected administrative fee is that people who are reaping the benefits of the statewide price agreements should be contributing to the funding stream for procurement services. So 55% of the revenue that we have budgeted for next biennium comes from the vendor-collected administrative fees. We add between half a percentage point and 1.5% onto the contracts. The decision on how much to add depends on price sensitivity. We want to make sure that we're not pricing those statewide price agreements out of the market. And it's been very successful over the last 8 or 10 years that it's been in place. While we're talking about funding for procurement services, I think another piece, we talked about assessments, George Naughton did earlier. Only 11% of procurement is funded through assessments, so about a $1.7 million assessment. The rest of the money comes primarily through transaction-based fees that we charge to agencies and through training fees that we charge to agencies. We conducted, so those agency-specific fees, they're generally 4.2% of a transaction, but we have caps because some of the really large IT procurements could generate a lot of money. So we have caps on those. It's a new model that we began at the beginning of this biennium in conjunction with our customer utility board. We're asking our chair and co-chair of that group to get together to take a look at the impacts of that new rate model and just want to make sure that it's as good as it can be. I think I've covered most everything there except training. House Bill 2375 requires, that was passed in the 2015 session, requires training on procurement for a variety, a large number of people. And while I'll talk about that here a little bit, I have some stats on that as a budget driver a little bit later on, but I want to make sure that you all know training is a big part of what the procurement team does for state agencies and for local governments, as a matter of fact. And the last thing I'll say about procurement for the moment is that one of our key metrics, you've asked over the last couple of days how we quantify our results. One of our key metrics is completing procurements by the agreed upon completion date. And at our last reporting period for the last quarter, we did that about 72% of the time. That's a new measure, and we feel pretty good about 72%. We think we can do better. We know there are some dynamics that go on within interactions between the business, procurement services, DOJ. We also know we can do a bit better job having staff track those metrics, so we think that number will go up over time.
You know, one of the things that committee that just hit me, and I guess I should have known this from a long time ago, but if there's really any one agency that operates like a business, it's the Department of Administrative Services, and that you're having to charge a fee to cover the work you do to provide the service to other agencies. And so that's one thought. And then that really helps us understand why that other funds portion of your budget is so large, because again, you're providing those services to agencies for a fee to maintain your operation to continue to provide those services.
Exactly.
And Mr. Co-Chair, I came from an agency that had a portion of the agency that did the same thing. And, you know, at the Department of Agriculture, we talked a lot about customer service and making sure those agencies that are those entities, in that case, it was farmers and ranchers and right. food processors, were receiving the customer service that they deserved. And we focused a lot of time and effort on that. In working now at DAS, we have that same focus here in terms of reaching out to that customer. How are we doing? Are we meeting your needs? How can we improve? And I think the statistic, frankly, that 57% of our procurement sale is not from state agencies, but from people right. that choose to use the system, is that's a big compliment.
Yeah, it's positive
for the staff.
Yeah. Any questions? Mm-hmm. Please continue.
So, Mr. Chair, we'll talk about risk management next, and then I think your discussion about the rate model provides a good lead into that. Now, we talked a little bit about last Thursday about how we set the risk fund level. So I think I'll just go ahead and start with that after saying that basically you can think of risk management as the state's insurance company. That's the simplest way to think about it. What we do to set the biennial amount is take a look at actuarial reports. We have an actuary that we hire. We get annual reports from them. They outline for us what they believe our risk will be over time. And over the last 3 years, I think, we've asked them to also take a look at what they think the payouts will be within specific biennia, so that we can more closely identify the amount of money that we think we need in the risk fund to cover our anticipated losses. This time around, we landed on an amount of $107.1 million as what we needed to add to the fund to keep it moving. And then, more to the point of the questions that you were asking earlier in the week, we use an allocation model for all of those agencies so that they really are paying based on their history and on their exposure.
Let me ask about that. So when it says insure state agencies, is that all state agencies?
Yes.
Does that include Department of Forestry?
Representative Smith, yes. The university system did leave us back in 2012, okay. So not them. With forestry specifically, we insure them for a number of different things, but we have a special insurance policy that we've purchased through the Lloyd's of London for wildfires, and it's unique in almost the entire world. So it's been a great partnership. We began to be worried that we would lose that a couple years ago as the wildfires got worse. We had to renegotiate insurance levels, contributions ahead of accessing the agreement. It's been a great partnership with forestry, and their director, Doug Decker, has been involved in that, and it's been I think, a great success.
So let me ask another question on that. So a state agency has an employee issue. It's going to end up in litigation. I assume we have professionals who look at the risk versus reward, and there's probably times where we could litigate it, but the risk may be greater than the reward, and so it's easier to settle and move on. Is that a fair assessment?
Mr. Co-Chair, it is, and speaking again from my previous position, mm-hmm. we had those cases in the department, and we would sit with the Department of Justice and really talk about the case. And as an agency director, you believe that what you did is right. You want to go to court.
Right.
And then the reality sets in terms of what that court case looks like and what the cost we expect to be and what the option are in terms of settlement. I was never comfortable settling, but there were many cases where we just made a fiscal decision,
right.
That settling was in a better way to go than taking it to court. And so that's a conversation that happens with the agency and DOJ. But DAS has the ultimate ability to say, no, you're going to settle to an agency.
To all agencies. Does that, when I say all, that includes Department of Corrections? I just want to be clear when I say
yes.
All agencies.
All agencies, yes.
Not
yes,
the
Mr.
Treasury Co-Chair. Department, though, right?
Okay. Treasury as well.
Treasury, yes.
We have the state's risk manager in the back of the room because we knew that.
Legislature
as well.
Apparently.
Separation of powers issue there.
We're the insurance company, Chair Smith, Representative Nierman. Just to put a little bit of context around that, last year we had a total of 2,322 claims come in, all varying types of claims. 177 of those actually went to litigation, so about 8%. We try to settle out of court because it's much cheaper.
Right.
And when we do find ourselves needing to go to court, we then work very closely with the trial division at DOJ and work with them to make sure that our strategy is as good as it can be. I will say that over the last year or so, we've had a few surprises because juries have lately seem to not like us very much, regardless of what the facts are in the case. And so we factor that in as well as we make decisions.
Let me ask one more question. I'm just repeating what you said. If I heard you correctly, each state agency then is assessed based upon their level of risk.
So, Mr. Chair, yeah, the
past history.
Yes, the allocation method is the past 4 years. That's the heaviest weighted piece. But we also take into account total insured value, the number of FTE they have, and one or two other factors. But primarily, it's their history.
Do you ever want to cancel one of the agencies and say we're done with you?
And sometimes they
go find a new insurer.
Mr. Chair, yes. On that point, I think there's a very interesting anecdotal point. When the Oregon State Fair became a separate entity 2-3 years ago, we were meeting with former Representative Berger, former Senator Durfler, Craig Smith, who's the chair of the committee, and we talked through a number of issues. One of them was insurance coverage, and they had a private broker with them, an insurance broker, as an advisor. After the negotiations, they decided to go with us because their broker said that he couldn't touch the rates and didn't think anybody else could. We don't have to build in profit margins or any of those types of things. So we're a good deal for state agencies, we believe.
Thank you for letting us dig into that. Any questions from the committee on this subject? Please continue.
I will move on to publishing distribution. Since you wanted a short meeting today, I feel like I'm taking all your time. Publishing distribution does printing and mail processing for state agencies. To give you a little idea of their volume, they do about 7 to 8 million pieces of mail per quarter, so pretty substantial. They also provide printing services to local governments. We do jury summons for all 36 counties at publishing and distribution, and we print the property tax statements for 17 of the counties in Oregon. Those are services they could get elsewhere, but they choose to come to us. On the volume of mail, I think it's really important as we talk about efficiencies over the week. We get, when we're able to process the mail and get it out through the best rates, we get a 10-cent discount on the typical piece of mail. At 7 million pieces of mail per quarter and 98% of our mail going through and getting that bulk rate, we can save about $686,000 each quarter in postage. We think that one of the future issues that will be a potential problem for us is that the post office has closed down its Salem office. I shouldn't say has closed down. It is likely to close it down over the next couple of years. They've really curtailed operations, and so we may need to adjust our shifts so that we can get the mail to Portland in time to get that preferred rate. One of the key –
Representative Gumberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Fascinating information there, and I say that sincerely. But with the increasing use of electronic communications, what are the future trends for the kind of volumes you're looking at sending out there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomberg, we have actually expected mailings to go down, but we're not seeing that so much. There are a lot of mailings that we send out that go to vulnerable populations, so DHS, OHA, they may not have access to electronic means of receiving their documents. But for those documents that we can, we have a small team of designers out at P&D that works with agencies to help them make sure that the documents are presented in a way that is as user-friendly as possible. Over time, if it goes down, we'll have to make adjustments to staffing levels and to our budget. It's surprising that we have not seen less. And I would say that one key metric that I wanted to touch on, we track the number of double stuffing incidents because we know that if our machines go awry and we put sensitive information in someone else's mailbox, that could be a terrible thing. We have had 4 instances over the last year where 4 pieces of mail have been double stuffed. So it's something we keep an eye on and report upon, but we don't have a problem. In those 4 instances, we've released no public, or I'm sorry, personal information in those. So we were happy about that, but take it very seriously. And then one other efficiency, through remodeling, we were able to reduce their footprint by 15% out at the print plant and allow the state data center to move staff in, including the enterprise security office and part of the plant we used to occupy. So looking for efficiencies out there all the time. Financial business systems, I mentioned them earlier. They are they maintain the payroll and accounting systems. They are also the administrator of the statewide SPOTS program, the Oregon State P-Card, Oregon State P-Card of Oregon Transaction System. That's a tough one for me to remember, but it's the credit card that we use to make a number of our payments. I'll talk about that in a minute with shared financial services, but Financial Business Systems administers that program. But we also provide payroll services to 31 client agencies, and those range from DCBS down to the smallest boards and commissions. When Director Pat Allen was here last week from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, he mentioned that as part of a project, he had transferred processing and payroll to our team, and that has been a big success. They are now our biggest client. They actually have more staff than DAS. We feel very proud about the job that we do. One of our key performance metrics for that payroll team is making sure that employees get their paychecks on time. That's easy during general cycles, but when Lisa Sumption was here yesterday talking about seasonal employees coming and going, we have an obligation to cut final paychecks for those employees and have them delivered that day. And we have that as one of our key metrics, and we are typically at 100% for those manual checks, and there's quite a volume, sometimes several thousand a month, depending on the season. I'll move on to shared financial services. They are the team that provides accounting services internally to DAS, and they also provide accounting services and some budgeting services to 22 client agencies. Those agencies include Oregon State Treasury. They asked us to take on their non-investment portfolio of accounting about a year ago. We've done that. We do accounting for the governor's office, accounting and budgeting, actually, for the governor's office and several other small agencies. We are especially focused on those agencies that don't have the a large enough staff to really ensure separation of duties. And that's a key internal control for our accounting teams. But we also do a good enough job that others have taken us on because we can be pretty efficient. Some of the efficiencies that we've implemented are using those SPOTS cards to make payments to a number of vendors. And we do that for primarily because it's much more streamlined. There's a lot less paperwork involved. It's just a simple credit card transaction. But those can generate rebates of up to 1.6% on each transaction. And we have been typically realizing about $45,000 a quarter, not a ton of money, but money that comes back to us. We take a look at that as compared to the interest rates that could be charged by hanging on to the money. And right now, interest rates are so low that those rebates are very attractive for us to generate. We continue to increase our usage of those and have explored things like paying our utilities with those. That would generate a huge rebate, but we haven't been able to make that work just yet for a number of reasons. I think a couple other things I'd like to point out. This team is DAS's financial reporting team. So when you talked about the comprehensive annual financial report yesterday, this is the team that provides the information that goes into that for DAS's portion, and that team has earned the State Controller's Gold Star for timely and accurate reporting for the last 12 years in a row, so they do a great job.
That's really impressive. That really is, yeah.
We have a great team there. The next slide, excuse me, shows our budget. You can see it goes down slightly. Most of that, as I said before, is the risk fund, $104.8 million. The rest of it is the operations fund. A good chunk of that operational fund is attorney general fees in the risk management program. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. Now to enterprise asset management. This is the team that manages our business, our office space, our buildings, the leasing program. We have custodians here. We have surplus property program and fleet and parking services. They touch 40, we own actually 45 different buildings. So this team takes care of those. Just to give you a little idea of the teams here, planning and construction management, 11 FTE, $3.3 million. Operations and maintenance, 123 FTE, $37.3 million. Real estate services, 15 FTE, $4.7 million budget. Surplus property has 15 FTE, $4.3 million as their budget. And fleet and parking services, 31.5 FTE, $43.7 million. All those numbers are in the governor's budget for next biennium.
So, can we go back to the? Sorry, on the fleet and parking, does that 40 plus million? Does that include acquisition of new vehicles, or is that? Tell me what's included in that.
Mr. Chair, yes, it does. They manage the fleet, and I can get to that on.
Are you coming to that? Okay. No,
yeah, the next slide here. But okay, well, we'll walk through this then so I don't lose my place in my notes here.
Okay.
So planning and construction management, they maintain the 45 DAS-owned buildings and parking structures. You heard about a facilities assessment, facilities condition assessment yesterday from George Naughton. Our buildings are actually in really good shape right now in terms of that assessment. 85% of the, or 80% of the buildings were identified as being in good condition, and only a handful in less than that. Without investments, though, in continuing to keep the buildings up, we see that number flop to the other side. And by 2023, we expect that about 80% of our buildings would be in bad condition. So we want to make sure that we can continue to invest in keeping our buildings up. In as good a shape as possible. It is quite a challenge. This team, planning and construction management, is not the one that actually does all of that work, however. They help with major remodels. They've been helping judicial department in their remodels of courthouses around the state. They're currently involved with Multnomah County. We'll be working with Lane County and another county in southern Oregon.
Question, Representative Gumberg.
Thank you so much. Give me 30 seconds on seismic resilience.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gumberg, 30 seconds, it's bad. That would be my quick assessment.
Well, give me 30 seconds more.
Just 2 seconds.
We had a seismic.
Like Humpty Dumpty, they all fall down.
Yeah. We know, Representative Gumberg, that most of the buildings on the Capitol Mall would fall in a major Cascadia event. That's why you've heard twice so far, and we'll talk about it here. We have $9.3 million in the governor's budget for buildings, a building on the yellow lot and another structure on the red lot that would become the resiliency building. If we get that approved and get that building built, that building, as you've heard, would be the center of operations following a major event. In the absence of a major event, we would use that building to move agencies out of buildings so that they could vacate a building, and then it would be seismically upgraded. Department of Revenue is one of the early ones on the list. The Labor and Industries building is one early on the list. Employment Department. We know we'd be in trouble. We are planning on addressing that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Oregonians, I'm sure, will be comforted to know that in the event of a major earthquake, we're going to keep taxing.
Co-Chair Representative Gomberg, I would also add.
Moving right along.
You don't have to respond.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. With the list that you said, a list of priorities, I noticed that there's been some concern about the Capitol itself. So where would the Capitol fall in order in terms of upgrades? I heard that this has been going on for a number of years.
Co-Chair Manning, we don't own the Capitol building, so it would be up to the legislative administration team to work on that. I don't know where it falls in the overall priorities.
Okay, so this is one of the property, or is this the only property? that we occupy, you know, as for state employees that DES doesn't have anything to do with?
Mr. Co-Chair, no, the Department of Transportation owns their building on the Capitol Mall. That's one we think would be most likely to stand during a major event. So there are a few other buildings not owned by DAS.
Like forestry owns their
Mr. Chair, forestry does own their building. I've been in that building. I don't think it would stand, however. What I'm talking about in terms of these priorities are the DAS-owned buildings.
Okay. Okay. I was my mistake, and I was assuming that DAS, since DAS owns just about everything, that these would also fall up under DAS's control as well.
Mr. Co-Chair, we don't want to have anything to do with the state Capitol building.
if you need a good two-hour conversation, go visit the Senate president and talk to him about his Capitol building.
Yeah.
Make it 3 hours.
All right, I'll move on to operations and maintenance. This is the team that does take care of the 3.4 million square feet of DAS-owned buildings. Our buildings include general government, just regular office-type buildings, forensic and crime labs, the state data center. The print plant is a DAS-owned building, as well as the governor's residence. So we take care of that one as well. Our team also there has the custodian program. And when Director Koba talks about the ambassadors of state government, I think the custodians are frequently the DAS people who people in buildings know. And so in many ways, those custodians and our shuttle drivers who deliver the mail really are the face of DAS to many employees. We have a performance metric around how well they do their job, and the data shows us that our customers are happy with the custodial services we provide. But anecdotally, we hear people talk about how pleasant it is to see their custodians each morning. And George Naughton likes to talk about the custodian in DAS West, the executive building. He's singing every morning and making the place a great place to show up at 7 o'clock.
Let me ask you a quick question. Is there a statutory reason the governor's mansion is not furnished?
Mr. Chair, that building was donated to us, and there have been, I think, conscious decisions in the past not to spend a lot of money on that by the governors themselves.
I think, Mr. Co-Chair, there have been fundraising events along the way for that building. I'm trying to remember the last time it was remodeled. But it was a private fundraising event.
I've been in it multiple times, and with no commentary on our governors, none whatsoever. It's sparsely decorated, and I'm not sure always presents the best image for the state of Oregon when dignitaries come to visit the state. And Governor Brown, no commentary, but that's been the case in the three governors that I've worked with.
Co-Chair Smith, another issue we face is that it is a historical building, and there are a lot of things we'd like to do to it, but just can't, even if we had the money, because we have to maintain that historical feel.
Would you just do just 2 minutes of due diligence and find, is there a statutory reason why we haven't furnished it?
We can look into that, Mr. Chair. I don't believe there is, but we can look into it. On operations and maintenance, that team also works very hard at keeping our antiquated systems running. So you've asked questions about deferred maintenance. Well, we've got buildings that have HVAC systems and plumbing systems that are end of life. We work hard in O&M to make sure that we keep those maintained. But I think they are some of the unsung heroes of state government when things go bad.
Some of our, Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Manning, Mr. Co-Chair, some of our HVAC systems are similar to a green screen. I mean, they're that bad.
Can't be hacked.
Exactly.
Die on their own accord, Mr. Co-Chair. Now, one other thing I would like to point out, when we talk about succession planning for the O&M team, the trades, our HVAC technicians, our electricians, our plumbers, we frequently lose them to the private sector after they attain journeyman status. So it's a real challenge getting people in. They get hired out after they become journeymen at higher wages in the private sector, and it's something that we need to really take a look at.
So we may need to speed up a little bit.
Yeah, so we have 29 minutes
finished
left
on time. All right.
This is the first time
Brett's
ever.
Brett's done a great job at describing all of this.
First time I've ever been told not to talk so much. Real estate services, very quickly. You've heard a lot about their savings through renegotiating leases. $64 million over the life of the leases were saved as a part of their project. And to put that in context, we pay about $65.7 million each biennium in leases. So we essentially saved a full biennium worth of leases. I won't spend a whole lot of time on this, just let you know that we manage, we negotiate 250 leases annually with the private sector, and we're always trying to look at ways to maximize our investment and agency services in those buildings. Fleet and Parking Services, you asked about that, Mr. Chair. They do purchase vehicles. You had asked a question earlier in the week about whether or not we could aggregate purchases. When I talked about statewide price agreements as part of procurement, we do actually aggregate all of that spend. Agencies buy off those statewide price agreements in almost all cases, except for some very specialized equipment, which is separate from that. We get really good deals from that. Surplus property is a fun program, actually. It's different than anything else that we do in DAS. We get all of the equipment that agencies don't want anymore and market that. A lot of times we get equipment from federal programs, and we're able to sell that or even donate that to local governments at a very small price, much better than what they would get. We've seen fire trucks out there, graders, all kinds of things, MREs even. So in a real disaster, we could go out there and find some food. A key metric for them is customer performance, and they scored a 4.75 out of 5 last cycle. Good. Budget slide goes down a bit. I'll talk about the reductions that caused that to go down a little bit later in the presentation. And now on to the budget drivers. For DAS information technology, you've already heard about legacy system maintenance, all of our COBOL-based systems. It is difficult to find those programmers. We have a lot of systems that were homegrown back in the day. We're trying to move away from that, but it is a cost driver for DAS IT. Our internal IT infrastructure, we've had varying versions of things like Adobe Acrobat. So we're working to get everybody within DAS up to the same version. That allows us to roll things out more uniformly. And then customer demand. We have agencies that ask us to do more, and we have sections within DAS that ask us to do more. The budget drivers for enterprise goods and services. Oh, thank you very much. One of the big ones for risk management is the increased torque cap limits. Those are now up to $2,073,000 per single instance for bodily injury, $4.14 million for multiple personal injury claims. What that has done is really driven up the complexity of the work that our risk management team has had to do. Those claims coming in, we talked about the percentage that go to litigation. That team of they deal with about 2,300 claims a year. Some of them are small and trifling, some really tough. And for those that are...
I don't mean to interrupt you. I apologize. Do you have trouble finding risk managers, hiring risk managers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we are having some. I talked with our risk manager about that earlier today. We have one of our members with 35 years of experience retiring in the next couple of months. We expect in the next year to lose another probably 100 years of experience between three or four people. And so we think we'll probably have to go outside of state government for some of those claims managers. A lot of whom we have on staff right now came from the private sector because it is really our insurance company. We look for that expertise, but there's not a lot of people waiting in the wings in state government.
Are we competitive in salary and trying to attract?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that. We can look into that, and I can let you know.
One last question. Actuarial staff, do we contract for that, or do we hire that?
Mr. Chair, we contract for that.
Okay.
We don't have actuaries on staff. We used to,
okay.
But decided it was much better to have an independent body be doing that work.
Okay, thank you. Sorry to interrupt you.
Let's see, attorney general costs are a big driver for risk management, projected to be almost $17 million next biennium out of their small operating budget. They continue to go up because DOJ needs to add more resources as we face the A-teams from the trial attorneys. Demand for services, I skipped over increased centralization of IT procurement. That's a workload driver for the procurement services team. So as we do fewer delegations in partnership with work the state chief information officer does, we're not doing as many delegations, which means we have to do more of the work. And some of those are pretty complex. Demand for services, as I mentioned, Department of Consumer and Business Services came on board. I wouldn't be surprised if more agencies start coming to us for those types of services. And then procurement training requirements. House Bill 2375 from 2015 requires quite a bit of new training, and we've been working on that. Our team has grown, and we put on we filled 1,644 seats so far this year for state and local governments on a variety of topics. We've had 20 different topics, 75 different learning events so far, and we've had 3 conferences to try to get the word out, and provided 20 webinars. I could talk more about that. I want to make sure that we cover everything here. The CAO budget drivers.
Yeah, we have a question.
Yes.
Representative Marsh.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair. When you talk about demand for services increasing and driving the budget, that those demand for services are also accompanied by a transfer, right, from the agencies that are seeking new services?
Representative Smith, Representative Marsh, it happens in a variety of ways because if we're taking on a small agency who has had those services provided somewhere else, they don't have the staff to transfer. So what we try to do is assess the workload that brings to us and see if we can absorb that. If we can't absorb it, sometimes we establish limited duration positions. Sometimes we have to come here and ask for positions. With the bringing on of Department of Consumer and Business Services for payroll services, we did essentially transfer one position from the agency. It's a little more technical than that, but they had 2 staff doing their payroll. Because of our infrastructure, we were able to do it with one, so essentially did transfer one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
For enterprise asset management, as I've mentioned, the aging buildings and systems, I talked about the 85% of the buildings in good condition right now, but if we don't stay on top of that, we will find ourselves in big trouble. Leased space is a budget driver, has been a budget driver in a good way over the last few years, as we've saved the $64 million we've talked about. Seismic vulnerability, we touched on that a bit earlier. That will be a huge budget driver. Fuel and utility costs are big drivers for the buildings we own. Sometimes that's a good thing. As gas prices come down, our fuel prices and expenditures have gone down. So that can go either way. And then the number of vehicles that we need to buy. When other agencies come and ask for additional staff to provide services, sometimes we need to buy new cars for them. Mm-hmm. And so we try to stay in lockstep with them to make sure that we have the vehicles they need. POPs included in the budget for DAS information technology. We've asked for one position to help with that desktop support that we talked about with the Technology Support Center. We're currently doing that through an LD because of the demand. Another really important part of that is, as I mentioned, we've only had DAS IT part of DAS proper, I think I heard George say earlier this week. So we really are working to get our hands around what we need in terms of resources to serve everybody. And then we also are asking for one application developer to support the eTime application that I showed you on my phone and the DataMart that I talked about that's our transparency website. We don't have dedicated support for that, and we get it as best we can from the resources we have. For enterprise goods and services, now we have a number of packages. The IT procurement and vendor management program, we're asking for four positions. That is really in partnership with the Office of the State Chief Information Officer. You'll probably hear him talk about the technology reference model tomorrow. And as part of that work, we're really looking to reduce the number of one-off procurements that are done for IT. We want more statewide price agreements in place that agencies can work on. The CIOs, the state CIOs portion of the work will be to identify who those vendors should be. The procurement side is to actually do the work of putting those statewide price agreements in place. It's been a great partnership, and we actually expect that we could expand from the current 70 statewide price agreements to over 200, so quite a bit of workload there. We want to also convert three LDs in procurement services to permanent. Those three are around House Bill 2375 and the procurement manual, the training, those types of things we talked about a bit earlier. And then one position out at publishing and distribution, it's an admin support position in the customer service team. We want to make sure that those customer service reps are out in agencies, making sure that they know what services they can buy from us, and having an admin person back at the office taking care of the administrative tasks will free them up even more to do that. We've asked for a position in risk management. That team is struggling with the workload that is coming their way because of increased tort cap limits and the complexity. One OPA 4 claims position in the team we think could help. It won't solve all the world's problems. I know Penny Evans is sitting behind me and wished I could ask for 10, but sorry, Penny, I can't do that. And then finally, establishing one OSPS position, that's the Oregon State Payroll System position. That actually is the one position that came to us as a limited duration position, Representative Marsh, from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So we're asking to make that one position permanent. And enterprise asset management. We've got five current LDs that we'd like to make permanent. One is a custodial services coordinator. That provides just administrative support to the custodial program so that we don't have managers or custodians themselves trying to do some of those basic administrative functions. We'd like to have a grounds maintenance worker to help maintain our grounds. As part of our risk remediation program, we've added some bioswales in some places. We've also added some drought-resistant landscaping at the 550 building, our new one over on at 550 Summer Street, I believe it is. Mm-hmm. We have some aging landscapes that we want to make sure that we continue to take care of. We've been working on all of those things with an LD. We want a permanent position. We're asking for one maintenance and operations supervisor. Currently, we manage the Portland State Office Building and have no supervisors up there. Not ideal. People need bosses sometimes, and we'd like to be able to provide them one. Project manager in the space utilization area. We have two planners who help design space for agencies, so office space and the cubicles people sit in. We've added a third as an LD to relieve some of that workload, and we'd like to make that permanent. And then finally, an administrative specialist, another administrative position for the real estate team. We want those leasing agents to be able to focus on leasing work and negotiations and those types of things, and have an admin support person do the nuts and bolts back home about, you know, getting all the right details into those lease agreements.
So let me ask Paul a quick question on that. On those positions, have you been able to identify which ones are general fund versus other funds on those? Or the agency get that to you?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they'd all be other funds because it's all funded through rates charged. In this case, probably rates charged to agencies, perhaps assessments.
But can we go back to the previous screen then really quick? Can you do a little 101 education for us? I need this. go to 56.
Went too far.
Yeah, 56.
Okay.
So we talked about positions such as janitorial manager and some of those type of positions. What other fund source would those are positions that are taking care of gas facilities. How do we charge another fund on that? Help me understand that.
Co-Chair Smith, those positions are primarily funded through the uniform rent rate or through self-support rent rate. We've got two rate models.
Okay.
So that's how we do it. And we do have to charge ourselves rent so that we're paying appropriately for those services. And the feds require us to do that as well. It's something that is a bit of a pain, frankly. But if we don't do it properly, the federal cost allocation circular requires that we pay them back for some of those charges.
Got it. And that's how that becomes other fund.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Representative Nierman.
Just real quickly, you're looking at some notes there that have more detail that's on the slides there. Can I get those notes, or do you have detail, or is that going to be on the LFO printout on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nierman, I'd be happy to give you those notes to you. Those are my notes so that I knew what I was talking about. I'm not sure you could actually read them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nierman, in the budget request that we submitted, there is narrative description on each of the packages. So we might start there and see if that gets you what you need. And
probably,
if you need something else, just let us know.
I think that'll do. Thanks. If you could get that to me.
And Co-Chair Smith, Representative Nierman, that's what I meant to say. Let's see. So reduction options in this portion of the budget. We only have a reduction of $40,000 in S&S for the internal DAS IT. And again, that goes back to the fact that it's so new that we want to make sure that we know what that team needs before we start making any changes. Now, we did ask for the two positions that we think we need because we already have LDs, but that's why that looks so slim in terms of reduction options. For the Enterprise Goods and Services Division, our reductions are all S&S. We don't have any positions reduced. We also, and I don't have these numbers in my head, we also have some cash that we have offered up. Mr. Siebert probably has that number in his head. So a combination of reductions in spending and cash balances are the reductions for EGS. And the reason for that is to try and continue to keep providing quality services to state agencies. And finally, last slide, in EAM, Enterprise Asset Management, reductions there are all S&S as well. Because we also want to make sure that we continue to provide the service that we can. I would point you at the last one there, though, that talks about eliminating building maintenance. I think it's important to highlight that one because that's not the kind of deferred maintenance that you've been asking about and that we've been talking about. This is really the washing of the buildings, the windows. When I talked to our EAM Administrator Shannon Ryan, she likened it to curb appeal. And so reductions here really are more cosmetic, not structural, and infrastructure.
So with that, Mr. Co-Chair, that gets us through our full presentation. Unless you have additional questions, we do have a list of the questions today, so we'll try to get those answers turned around as soon as possible and respond to you.
Representative Nierman.
So thanks, Mr. Co-Chair. I just want to open up a little can of worms here. So I appreciate the work that you do on the transparency website. I used that even before I became a state representative. And I know that when that first started out, with it was kind of Senator Thatcher's brainchild, and I appreciate the work that she did on that, that DAS kind of made an agreement that we'll just do it for free out of whatever resources we have rattling around. And I appreciate that. I appreciate the spirit that, in which that was done. But I'll put this question to you. Is it maybe time to I saw you had a pop for a position on that. So I guess we've outgrown the era of the free transparency website. And I'm okay with that. And I'm almost wondering if maybe we need to take a little bit of a bigger leap on that. I'm kind of familiar with the state of Utah's transparency website, which I'm really impressed with, where you can subscribe to notifications and things. So it's the our transparency website kind of just seems like a coat closet with a bunch of hooks in it, and it's good, but it's just whatever we got, we just kind of put there, and whatever some legislator wanted to bang on the drum about or whatever got put there, and that worked for. But if there could be some, is it possible to do some work to actually get something that maybe goes to the next generation, the next step?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nerman, it would be possible with resources. Our request is basically to just keep it going as it is. Our request is also partially in light of the budget deficit we're taking a look at dealing with this biennium. So right now, primary goal, just keep it working. And we want to have that dedicated resource so that we don't find ourselves in a position where we're not able to keep it working.
So, Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Nierman, obviously we're available to visit with you about what some options would be in terms of making the site more useful. As always, we support the governor's recommended budget, and there aren't resources in the budget to do that now, but we're certainly happy to have the conversation and think about what it might look like, and if you all decide that you want to find those resources, we'll leave that up to you.
Good. Thanks. I appreciate the work that you do on that, so thank you.
Perfect. Mr. Co-Chair, any questions?
No questions for me. Thank you, sir.
Good. Any other questions from the committee? Paul? All right. Michael, you good?
Yes, sir.
Madam Director, you're good? You're good? Michael, you good?
Yes, sir.
Madam Director?